Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly, where this weekly we'll see what we can learn about thinking from the Antiques Roadshow, meet the voices of rural electrification in Castlebar and the voices of Irish opera in Galway, and later on we'll make the rounds of the big shows at this year's Galway Arts Festival. But we begin with the Antiques Roadshow and its American cousins. Our media soothsayer Owen Nolan has been looking deep into the heart of his streaming media subscriptions for metaphors of creativity and human promise, and bedad doesn't he find them in a piece we call A Slightly Unreasonable Point of View.
The Antiques Roadshow of Ideas. In the before times, TV viewers in Ireland were divided between those in multi-channel land and everyone else. We made solemn appointments with the simulated teak finish set, racing home across the fields to watch the latest episodes, gathering to watch British TV and Irish TV and American imports on both. The room went quiet when the news came on. There wasn't much news, but it was terribly important. Television was drip-fed and over by midnight. Now screens are not just in every room, but in every bag or pocket, and content is less a drip and more an endless stream. Yet for the Anglophone viewer, it remains dominated by American and British content. Sometimes, like Spot the Difference pictures, it's by observing the variation that we get to really take in the detail. By looking closely, we can see what just glitters and what, if anything, is real gold. BBC's Antiques Roadshow is quintessentially British. After all, the belief that you have undiscovered treasure in your attic can only be sustained in a country that A, used to have an empire stealing other people's treasures, B, still has a level of inherited wealth, or at least a rich Aunt Ethel, and C, has dwellings big enough to have attics. The Antiques Roadshow arrives like some royal caravan to hold court in a random stately home. There is fanfare. People bring along curios of potential treasures to find out from the experts what they have and what it might be worth. The roadshow experts themselves are like sophisticated carnival folk. They have names like Bunny, Rupert and Alistair, and most are men. Some are brightly attired or wear an interesting hat, while others are more sober. In linens or tweeds, with cut-glass accents, it's easy to imagine their knowledge of valuable antiques began by having spent an idle childhood in a house full of them. Meanwhile, over on Netflix, US show Ghost Town Gold is also an Antiques Roadshow, but in this one, the two experts travel in a pickup truck. Britt and Scott explore the many ghost towns and abandoned mining camps of the old Wild West. Britt is enthusiastic, knowledgeable, and talks a lot. Scott is an expert on old guns and he hangs back a little, but also knows his subject. The Ghost Town Gold Roadshow arrives at no fanfare and sometimes no invitation. They persuade wary landowners to let them explore old barns or derelict buildings, looking for everything from spurs to mining lamps, old guns or manky-looking Levi jeans. Britt and Scott both wear cowboy hats that are remarkably beaten up, and when they meet a toothless rancher wearing an equally grease-stained and sat-upon hat, they buy it right off his head. They both carry huge rolls of dollars in their pockets and they like to give the property owners money for something early on in the transaction. They call it priming the pump. Britt in particular is not shy about exploring basements, climbing into spider-ridden attics, or even diving into an icy well to recover old whiskey bottles or rusty souvenirs of cowboy days. Britt, and occasionally Scott, will produce the wad from their pocket and make an offer. The retail value of the item is shared on screen with the viewer and often with the vendor. Britt and Scott will make an honest profit, but aren't out to cheat anyone. Britt also rents things to movie productions and seems to have customers in mind for specific objects. There are jokes about bank checks, but everything is cash. In one interaction, as a wad of $600 or $700 is handed over, the vendor remarks that the money is damp. That's sweat, explains Britt. On BBC's Antiques Roadshow, you sense it may be a while since Bunny or Rupert handled actual banknotes, never mind sweaty ones. Valuations are delivered with cautious calm and met with a kind of automatic disbelief from the punter, seldom with obvious disappointment. Instead, even when the valuation is surprisingly modest, well-groomed middle-aged people gasp to learn that the vase Aunt Ethel left them is worth a staggering 600 quid, even though they probably drove it there in a car worth £20,000. The most common refrain is that they're not going to sell whatever the object is, but intend to keep it in the family. Sometimes you wish they'd break the paradigm, flog the keepsake, and blow the proceeds on hookers and cocaine. Maybe it's what Ethel would have wanted. On Ghost Town Gold, people sometimes hold out for more dollars, but seem genuinely pleased, if not bemused, that these two young men turned up to buy rubbish from their outhouses. While we do learn that manky-looking old Levi's can be worth $5,000, not everything is for sale, and Britt and Scott can leave nearly empty-handed, but usually because they found an heirloom the owners didn't know they had. Satisfyingly, the viewer often sees the completion of a transaction where both parties are content with the outcome. Back over on BBC, where few ever declare an interest in cashing in their antique, or at least not in front of the cameras, that may be a difference between the US and the UK. The French Revolution's guillotine cast a long shadow, reaching even over the parapets of the English aristocracy, and money remains a delicate subject. Wealth, especially old wealth, is signalled more than brandished, encoded by choice of school, hyphenated names and postcodes. Meanwhile in the US, wealth is openly celebrated, admired and aspired to, whether you're a politician, tech lord or rapper. Perhaps because the American peasant has been repeatedly told that they too can live in the castle someday, the revolution has never come and the US has not yet experienced the guillotine. Unless Britt has found a rusty one in that last ghost town. Being a creative director in an ad agency can be like being one of those roadshow valuers. In response to a brief, a young team comes in to show you their wares in the form of concepts. Sometimes they're convinced they've got a rarity, a one-of-a-kind idea of worth. It can be the creative director's duty to point out that it's mass-produced or inauthentic. Occasionally, though, a team will have something they think is probably just rubbish and are almost reluctant to show you. And sometimes, if you're very lucky, you can see instantly they have that genuine original, an eye-catching, unpolished gem, a valuable idea.
Owen Nolan of Brand Artillery with a slightly unreasonable point of view. And don't forget to check out his previous unreasonableness on the Culture File page on SoundCloud or on the Lyric site. And Kitchen Power next in a new exhibition uncovering the effects, great and small, of electrification and its many devices on the women of rural Ireland. The exhibition features personal accounts from women who witnessed and benefited from the arrival of domestic appliances, appliances which, apart from relieving them of hard labour, gave them something precious, time.
The ICA were telling the younger members, if they weren't married, not to marry a farmer unless he promised to get the electricity into the house and get water on tap. My name is Dr. Saoirse O'Brien and I work for Kingston University in London and I am one of the two curators of the Kitchen Power exhibition, which has just opened in the National Museum of Ireland Country Life in Castlebar. So the idea of the exhibition is that it's looking at rural electrification, which happened in the 1950s and 60s in Ireland, but it's specifically looking at the effect that it had on women and very much the effect that it had on the home, particularly the kitchen. Because rural electrification happened in the 1950s and the 1960s, it's the time period before the marriage bar was actually lifted in the 1970s. And an awful lot of women were not working outside the home. So their main experience with something like rural electrification was through domestic appliances that were bought and brought into the house once their area was actually electrified. And the idea with the exhibition is to try and capture that moment, which it's quite a long moment, it's about 20 years worth of one. the term drudgery comes up all the time, because we did a set of oral histories for the project, and the word that comes up all the time is drudgery, talking about electricity coming in and reducing the amount of drudgery that Irish women had to deal with every day of the week.
It left everybody, I think, happy.
Yeah.
Because it took the drudgery out of all the hard work, you know, that people had to do. Like, it, you couldn't believe, like, I can always remember my mother saying, oh, she says, I think this is heaven. She says, this has to be heaven. She loved it. She loved it.
Electrical appliances would have been available in the cities from the very early 20th century. But if you live outside of the very basic grid that was put in after Ardna Crusha was built on the Shannon, then you're talking about the rural electrification scheme itself being started by the ESB in November 1946. And it spread basically from 1946 all the way up into the middle 60s before they get all of those areas covered. And then what they were doing during the late 60s and into the 70s was going back and doing an infill project to get people who didn't get sign up for whatever reason in the first place to signed up then. Because for a lot of people, they would have been worried about the cost. An awful lot of the work that the ESB were doing was trying to actually let people know about electricity and to understand about it and what can it actually do for you. An awful lot of the advertisements were aimed towards women, particularly of domestic appliances. They're pretty much all aimed at women.
And did they have any women then involved in the managing of this to advise on how to aim these products towards women?
Yes, the really interesting group of women involved in this are the ESB demonstrators. They're the people who went out and talked to women who had just bought a new appliance and made sure they were used to it. Their main part of their job was going out to houses after there was a large purchase made. And officially, the reason was to make sure that it was working okay. But really what they were doing is making sure that she knew what she was doing and that she had to give her confidence using this. So it's very much about sort of technical education and educating women about technology.
There must have been then a whole section of women that were more technologically advanced than the men of rural Ireland at that time.
In theory. I think what you have is that there's an awful lot of women in rural Ireland were very, very keen on electricity because they realised quite quickly what it could do for them. And particularly the Irish Country Women's Association, the ICA, were very, very big supporters of this because they realised how much of a difference it could make to the living conditions of their members.
And I think most of us were conscious that if you did it and gave people confidence, then they tell their sister or they tell their friends or up the road, because through the chat and maybe a cup of tea, you'd hear, well, we have this because my sister, she got one of those and she says it's the thing she needed.
It's all about networking and it's all about communication and it's all about women supporting each other and helping each other to try and improve their living conditions. Because really, you're not talking about a time period where there's much challenge to the gender stereotypes and the gender roles that you would have had in Ireland at the time. That really doesn't start happening until the 1970s. But an awful lot of this, I think there's a lot of the groundwork is being laid of freeing up time for women out of that drudgery to actually be able to start thinking about bigger things.
Saoirse O'Brien there, and the reporter was Áine Gallagher. And Kitchen Power, Women's Experiences of Rural Electrification, is now on at the National Museum of Ireland Country Life in Castlebar. Now, Irish opera is still happening. Irish National Opera has been peppering the country with opera since it was founded in 2018, but this summer premieres at Galway a brand new opera by Belfast composer Brian Irvine. But as ever, Irvine's work stretches categories and, least like the other, features a classical ensemble, some of the composer's regular improv collaborators, singers, actors, and lots of eye-popping video work. All of this is marshalled to tell the story of Rosemary Kennedy, whose life was every bit as ill-starred as her brothers Jack and Bobby Kennedy, as Brian Irvine told Culturefile.
Music is this massive spectrum of stuff. you know, and at one end you have, like, I don't know, the Sex Pistols. And then the other end you have, like, Shostakovich or Messiaen or whatever. And in the middle of it, there's all this other stuff. I've never felt one has to stay within a certain dimension of music. You can pull stuff from jazz world and mash it together with something from a contemporary world, or pull something from an old world. That's what's so exciting, you know, is you can mash all these things together. There's no rules.
Two.
It was a friend of mine, Lawrence Roman, who told me about Rosemary Kennedy about 5 years ago. And that kick-started a process of gathering texts and documents and interviews, and really started a whole process of investigating what actually happened to her. Rosemary Kennedy was the eldest daughter of Rose and Joe Kennedy, sister of JFK, Bobby Kennedy. And she was born with mild learning difficulties into the Kennedy family of sort of quite high achievers. And ultimately, that led to her father, Joe, organising a frontal lobotomy for her, which was a kind of experimental surgery pioneered, if you like, or devised by Walter Freeman as a kind of cure for her mild learning difficulties. And the operation, of course, went horribly wrong because it was just such a brutal and unscientific operation. And she was left incapacitated then for the rest of her life. I mean, I was fascinated because I didn't know the story of her. And the thing about Rosemary, which captures your imagination in many ways, was that she was hidden away for 20 years and she wasn't visited by any of the Kennedys for 20 years. And part of that is because I think the advice that the Kennedys were given was that it would be too emotionally traumatic for her. I mean, Rosemary had mild learning difficulties. She kept a diary until she was in her 20s. She learned French. She taught a little bit as a Montessori teacher. She's what you would describe as very moderate to mild learning difficulties. So I was quite fascinated by the whole process that was kind of led to everything that happened to her, and the light that it shone on a kind of very patriarchal society.
Dr. Martin Barr has been counselling us for nearly half a century.
In terms of music, I think the best way to describe it is, I suppose it's an after-modern type of music in that there are a lot of stylistic things that we recognise. There's one section which it sounds like it's going from a big band, and then the big band start to play kind of minimalism.
Yeah. There are some underlining threads, if you like, even just musically in the opera, and one is about systems and disruption of systems. 4 or 5 years ago when I started this project, I started writing a lot of pieces. I ended up with all these fragments of pieces, probably around about 30 to 40 fragments. I wrote several orchestral versions of things and recorded them. So I ended up with this kind of massive bucket of stuff, which I didn't necessarily understand what it was, but I knew it was connected to this. And then I paired up with Nisha Jones, the video designer and director of the show. And Nisha and I worked very closely then for a couple of years, trying to create something which drew upon those fragments. And in the show, we use essentially 13 fragments. But beyond that, there's like a pool of another 20-odd fragments. And
I feel there's a remix coming on.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a lovely way to work in some ways, because there's no sort of direct narrative that you're following, but it's you're always working very instinctively, I suppose, you know.
The world around her, a lot of it is the media. It's kind of radio and television versions of science.
That's it. The media had a curious role in the whole Kennedy life. In some ways, I think that sort of fed into their concerns about Rosemary and how she would appear as part of that media. There's a story that when she went to meet the Queen of England, you know, she tripped a little bit, didn't fall, but tripped a little bit on TV. And there was a sense that that was slightly embarrassing for the family and so on. And it was actually shortly after that Joe took the drastic steps of organising the lobotomy, you know.
the distinction between opera and operetta is probably, it's not really maintained in the outside world, but it's certainly not maintained in yours, because there are large parts where we're listening to speech, but yes, the speech is clearly part of the score.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it sort of weaves between speech and vocal lines, and a lot of the things we were interested in doing was the layering of certain things, you know, and sometimes the layering of sort of polar opposite things, which is a thing that we're attracted to, you know, and it's the dichotomy of those two things which creates something that you feel quite hard to articulate. And that happens, I think, when you sing and have text and have narration and have imagery, you're sort of pulled into a world that you're trying to make sense of, but all you're really left with is how it makes you feel.
Composer Brian Irvine on his Least Like the Other. And finally, on this week's Weekly, we take the Galway train to sample some of what's on offer in the city this summer.
The 2019 Galway International Arts Festival begins back in Ballinasloe, where the train halts for an hour or so, waiting on more clement weather. Rain, you see, has fallen in the west of Ireland for the first time, and transport infrastructure is understandably amazed and paralysed. Meanwhile, at the business end of the line, Irish National Opera was premiering Brian Irvine's Least Like the Other, a shocking catalogue of mid-century torture and repression practiced on JFK and Bobby's sister, Rosemary. But hold that thought for a moment while we have a look around. Crowds were excellent for the main show in the festival's visual art programme. That is, if your idea of excellence is large, which for the organisers it surely is. But popularity means that movement in the new space off a laneway at the bend of Shop Street is via sluggish procession. As it happens, this is a reasonable way to consume San Jink sculpture, a collection of Merc-like hyperreal wax humans posed in classical postures, updated with modern clothes and haircuts. Echoes of Pieta's past, hints of crucifixions gone by, the presence of so much perfectly stubbled fleshy death, and of course the Merc with shafts of golden light canonizing the sculptures, all gives the Sunday morning drop-in a sense of hushed pilgrimage, like a visit to a shrine, with that same tang of ecstasy and hoax. The dead are, and indeed is, everywhere in Druids Festival contribution, Epiphany, a premiere of a new work from writer Brian Watkins, a Juilliard alum and American to boot. But not to worry, his writing here springs from Irish literature and never quite escapes it, for all its fluid casting and post-everything phobia of specificity. Epiphany gives James Joyce's best-known Dubliner story, The Dead, a reboot, and indeed a boot, but keeps a table full of retro food stuff served to a squiffy, loquacious ensemble in a snowy townhouse, here gently ruled by Mary Mullen. As in Danny Boyle's film Yesterday, the characters here have forgotten something that everyone used to know, in this case, the meaning of epiphany in both the Christian and Joycean senses. There's clearly something waiting to be grasped from a tiny outbreak of stories about collective forgetting in 2019, alongside a moral panic, also activated here, that our devices are the enemy of conversation, conviviality, and everything we used to know as society. But Watkins' characters are forgetting with a purpose. Epiphany is anti-epiphanic, swerving violently whenever its headlights illuminate something in the road ahead. Revelation is not the style of knowledge acquisition to save this world. It's the Feast of the Walshes in playwright Ender's new work for Galway, produced by his old company Corca Dorca. Staged at the now defunct but nicely preserved early century airport in Carnmore, and starring a brace of additional Walshes, Eileen and Catherine. After a spell of unwarranted waiting in a corridor with time to observe the perfectly preserved posters boasting Galway Airport as your gateway to the globe, we take our seats on a grazing herd of institutional chairs chairs scattered around departures, we being both the audience and the two performing waltzes. Then, as we tune into the rain battering the airport's metal roof, the waltzes begin to unpick their lives and their wounds. Or is it their life and their wound? As is the way with Ender's writing, something has happened here and we can see its aftermath, scar tissue mostly, but not the something itself. But give it an hour and that should change, somewhat, though not completely. This playwright is fond of the unsayable and acutely sensitive to the exact quantity of words that won't say it. Sharp fragments of language fly, always in danger of mid-air collision. Memories and hurts spill. Eileen's brimming eyes implore. The airport is revealed as a care home, perhaps. The present as a crack in the past, maybe. And these two minds are struggling to be even one. Take that, show fans. And then we're released again into the dark, rainy car park several miles outside of town. Back in the black box, Brian Irvine's opera, Least Like the Other, turns out to be equally enigmatic for an entirely different reason. If it is indeed an opera, this teetering bonfire of sound onto which Irvine and his two bands toss fizzy slabs from big band to crazed minimalism, newsreel narration and plaintive arias. All of this is accompanied by a stage design with dense video from director and co-creator Netia Jones. But the shape of this element is mostly guesswork, as the train dallied too long in Ballinasloe. When this latecomer gets to the theatre, he's refused entry to the black box's auditorium, though kindly supplied with a chair so I can sit at the door and see what I can hear, so to speak. It wasn't so bad or so unusual. That's how culture works sometimes, isn't it? You sit there with your face pressed to the door, trying to make out what's going on, grasping parts, half-sensing others, noticing occasionally, with a feeling like an itch, that something quite important is missing.
Dispatches from the festival front line bringing to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. The Daily Culture File is on a wee break from next week, but the Culture File Weekly will be back next Friday with the first in a series of favourite episodes. That's starting at 7 p.m. next Friday here on RTE Lyric FM.